Welcome to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast,
your source for everything outdoors.
Let's kick it into overdrive.
Overdrive Outdoors Podcast, brought to you by Predator Hunter Outdoors. Whether you are new to predator hunting or looking to upgrade your equipment, Predator Hunter Outdoors will have you hunting after the sun goes down. Carrying a full line of lights, night vision, and thermal optics, along with tripods, calls, mounting systems, and more, check them out at www.predatorhunteroutdoors.com or on Facebook at Predator Hunter Outdoors. Use promo code OVERDRIVE2021 for 20% off your order.
All right, this is episode 5 of the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast, and today we have Kyle Hansbarger from First Fight Tactical Solutions with us. Kyle, you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
What's happening? I got invited to come do the podcast. Backstory on me, right out of high school, joined the Marine Corps, spent 8 years in the Green Machine. I was an 0351, which is an anti-tank assault man. So I launched rockets at tanks and did demolition and mines and all that kind of stuff. Got the Marine Corps. Well, towards the end of my enlistment, I became a close combat instructor. So I did that for the last like year and a half. Got out of the Marines, used GI Bill, became a paramedic and a fireman. So I do that too. And then long story short, when I went to get my CPL, I sat in a room of like 35 people and thought, man, the only one in this room that should have a gun is me. So I thought, man, I'm going to go be an instructor. And so thus First to Fight was born all of 13 years ago. And that has expanded literally from just doing one weekend every couple months to training your buddies to we're busy usually doing a training class 2 weekends a month. And then now we have a class 7 FFL, and I've got my class 3 for the suppressors and stuff. So we're doing custom work. And then we launched 4 years ago, I launched the premium ammo line. Been focusing a lot more on that for predator hunting and stuff, which kind of brought me here. It was actually pretty cool because when I did the Predator Grand Prix last year, the year before when I went up there, it was pretty cool to see all them guys come in. And, you know, there was, I forget, 100 and some dogs or whatever. And I think there was, 40 some dogs were shot with my bullet. So that was pretty cool to be up there and talk to a bunch of them guys. So
yeah. I remember that. Didn't you offer a prize for like whoever shot the most with your ammo or something?
I gave them 3 boxes of ammo and they did with them. I think one was a quantity one or most dogs or something. And then we had some of the cool ones, man. Kyle shot a fox in the head with one I built at like 300 yards. I was like, man, that's pretty good poke, but.
And a small target to boot.
Yeah. Yep. So it's been cool. You know, I love shooting long range. It's kind of the thing I like to do the most. And it's one of the classes that we teach. I love to shoot a rifle at distance. So when I got started, I was going to make deer rounds for guys was all I was really kind of getting into it for. And then, Clinton came to me and was like, hey, have you ever thought about making something for predators? I was like, yeah, how hard can it be? I can make deer bullet. I'd be able to make a predator bullet. And so obviously 223 is usually where you start. Everybody's got one. And I started with 3 bullet offerings there. And then I was, to my knowledge, one of the only people that in the beginning, you could buy what I called like combo packs. So I did 6 rounds of each load that I made. So you didn't have to buy a box of 20 and go, man, my rifle hates that. And I've got 14 of them left. You could buy boxes that had literally, 4 or 6 of each thing I offered in it. And you could shoot and say, hey, all right, my gun likes this one. Now I'm going to buy this. And we don't do a whole lot of it anymore. Just not a lot of people ask me for it. Now most of them kind of just know which one they want. Plus with the homework that I've got into it now with all the different calibers and stuff, usually you can call me and tell me my barrel's this long and I got this twist. And I can say, yeah, you probably want to just run this one. So
going back, you went into the Marine Corps fresh out of high school, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you served 8 years, you said?
Yep, I did 8. We went to Iraq in 2003, and then I was a close combat instructor prior to the 2006 deployment for Fallujah. So
where did you do that at?
My close combat instructor was done out of down in Kalamazoo, the Army National Guard base right there. We did a 10-day instructor's course for that. And basically, the gist of it was we realized after the first deployment, militarily, Marine Corps wide, that we needed to work on a few things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Marine Corps is very astute on marksmanship. It's their big deal.
Right.
And what we weren't focusing on was, you know, being comfortable with a bunch of guys walking around with loaded weapons all the time. We had just hadn't been to war in a while. And so the whole course basically revolved around shooting and moving and being able to kill people in rooms about the size of a pole barn. So
did you guys go do a bunch of training at the mount facility?
Yes. We did a bunch in Alpena. And then obviously when I was out in Pendleton, and then we did some of the mountain town stuff in Lejeune when I was down there for the engineers course. So yeah.
Since you got out of that, then you came back to the civilian life, so to speak.
Yep.
You started First to Fight Tactical Solutions. Since then, have you continued? Have you taken any other courses to kind of keep yourself sharp and update your curriculum?
Yeah. So what I've done, all not only that, is the guys that I have, I got 6 employees, and they're all of various skill sets and then different times of deployment and when they got out. So for one of our main ways that's been nice is you get guys that, you know, just got out of the service 3-4 years ago. Hey man, why don't you come in and teach us what you've got there? As far as that, like the martial arts programs, I study with a couple different guys, and then my EMS side of it. So we do like a combat lifesaver class. So I've got buddies that are still in the Navy. So I get forwarded all the latest crap on that. And then I stick with doing that. As far as the guns go, you know, once you're in this world long enough, this realm, everybody seems to know somebody that can teach you something. So yeah, as far as like commercial courses, I haven't really gone out and done a lot of that. As far as like NRA stuff, I'm certified for 5 different disciplines. And then one of the other instructors has got everything except his instructor to train the trainers. So yeah, we try to stay out there and moving on just about anything we can.
So when you started First the Fight, did you start it by yourself, or was it a group of guys that started it?
So I got the idea kind of on my own, and then I brought in one of the machine gunners that was in weapons platoon with me. Brad and I kind of got it going, and then that went for about 2 years or so. He took a job in Alpena, so it really limited his time that he could be around, so he kind of faded out a little bit, and then I built my shop. So I built my 40x60 shop, and then I actually got partnered up through Freedom's Finest Outdoors. I started helping them do hunting and fishing stuff for wounded vets. And lo and behold, that turned into basically like a hiring pool. I was able to actually pull some guys that had some similar experiences and knowledge. So I hired my first couple guys from there. And then since then, we've kind of just brought in, I've come actually full circle. I just hired 2 that were in my unit that both got wounded in Fallujah in 06. So that's kind of rounded it out. Now it's, I started out, I had somebody from every branch of the service, minus the Coast Guard and the Navy, and now it's pretty much all Marines again. We're hard to get along if we pick on the other services a lot.
Right.
You have to have really thick skin.
Right. What all courses do you guys offer? Obviously, you said long range, and I'm assuming you do CPL courses. What other type of courses do you offer?
So we run a CPL, we run a pistol operations or attack pistol class. There's a level 1 and a level 2. You got to take 1 before you can take 2. Same with the carbine. And then we do a shotgun course, which I teach a bunch of the breaching stuff that we did. And then some just shotgun operation stuff. We do a land nav course. So if you ever want to learn to read a map and stuff, we got that one. Combat lifesaver, I do. The long range, we have... McMap. So we have a martial arts open hand defensive one that we teach. And then up until last year, we also had, me and the guys built a house at the range. So we did have a full on mount house you could use.
Oh, very cool.
We took it down last year. It needed a bunch of revamping. And then with lumber going nuts, we didn't end up putting it back up. But the gun club that I work with most, which is Oak Hill Gun Club in outside of Portland, they have assured me that as soon as lumber comes back to somewhere normal, we're going to actually, rebuild the house. So we'll be back doing mount. I also do a hybrid course for teachers and businesses. We do an active shooter, active response one. We've taught that at like Waverly High School and then some of the elementary schools, teach them some first aid stuff. It's just hard to get it around people's head. They think, you know, they call 911, they get something immediately. Well, I worked with SWAT for a short time, and like we're talking hours, man. Especially if the shooting has potentially stopped and we're not sure where it's at, then it takes us a minute to get going. So
right. Absolutely. So it sounds like you guys offer a pretty well-rounded curriculum. Do you do any law enforcement or military training?
So last time, what we had done for security, I've taught tons of security teams, like for churches and stuff. Mm-hmm. We've done some law enforcement stuff. A lot of the cops that I've had have just been more like, they kind of want to go into what the operation, like our pistol operation, obviously militarily somewhat different than law enforcement side. Right. And, you know, like you said before, it's, there's always more than one way to skin a cat. The way we run a rifle, it's a little different than the way some people do. I've even had students that have been in that have taken classes like at MDFI and stuff like that. The way mm-hmm. they operate a pistol is different than the way I operate a handgun. So it's, you know, it's nice to pull in those tools, you know, we,
And that's something I've seen too. I've trained with Delia Tactical. I don't know if you ever heard of them. They're based out of Fremont, and he actually does a lot too of heavy vehicle training all over the country for the military and law enforcement. Does a lot with MRAPs and different stuff like that. But he offered tactical shotgun, tactical pistol, tactical carbine that I took. And then I've also trained up at MTC. So yeah, exactly to your point, different instructors, everyone has a little bit different take on what they teach and how they teach it. So I don't know. I've always been a fan. I started training in martial arts in 1988, started doing competitive pistol shooting and stuff like that, probably early 90s. So one thing that I've always liked is to have well-rounded training. So seeing a little bit different from everybody, to me, just does nothing but to enhance your training.
Sure. And that's why, you know, when I first started, it was like, oh, I'm only going to work with Marines, you know, because that's the guys I like, you know. Come to find out, like when Jesse worked with us, he was with the 101st. The 101st did it different than we did it. Yeah. No, not wrong, just different. Right. Will's our Air Force security guy. He did two tours to Afghanistan. The way they do it is just different than the way we do it. And so it's nice to have, you know, that different thought process even. And some guys, it's cool, like with Will, with being security forces, you know, their specialty more with what he was doing was more room to room and vehicle stuff. Like he spent a lot of time focusing on that, you know, that operational set. When we went in 03, it was convoy operations and how do you dismount from a vehicle and kill everything that's in your way. And it just was a different mindset. Sure. In 06, it was buildings, man. How do you go from one street to the next street? So yeah, it's crazy to realize that even on your own team, you know, you look at four or five branches of service, they're doing it different.
Go ahead.
Just because of, you know, that's why there's so many different SEAL teams and stuff like that. Like everybody has their niche. This is what we're going to fall into.
Yep, absolutely. So now going to your, let's go to the hand-to-hand stuff. Have you stuck with what you were trained in the military for your hand-to-hand instruction, or have you branched out to something a little bit more hybrid, so to speak, picked up other things?
So yeah, I like to stick with the McMap for the most part. I have one of my buddies, Kent Nelson. He does a little more hybrid stuff. He does a lot of like sticks and knives and stuff like that. Which
in Prima and Cali?
Yeah. Like Cali, I know, is the one he focuses on a lot.
Yep.
And for me, it's like, it was cool to learn some of the stuff. On the other hand, it was like, well, I don't really carry a stick around very often.
Right.
So it's kind of like I get where you're at. But on the other hand, it's like, eh. And, you know, for me, the aspect I liked most, especially from the Marine Corps martial arts standpoint, was like ground fighting was something that we're just better at. You know, when you start talking about martial arts, like, look, man, I'm not a high kicking dude. I'm a 6 foot tall fat guy. I don't kick real high. Right. You know, I can kick hard low, but I can't kick you in the face. Right. But if I can get up close to you where you can't punch me and we can go to the ground, I can start doing something about it. So I think it was more like, as I tested a few of those fighting styles and stuff, I went, well, the way I'm built and the way I like to fight is this way. So this is the one I'm going to try to perfect. Not that there's not a better way to learn it. Like the Mastro defense system, I think there's actually some cool points to what he's doing. On the other hand, some of it, when you watch some of their training stuff and you go through it, you're like, well, you know, how much is this guy just doing what you want him to do? That's the hard part about any martial arts stuff. Like when you're working on it, your partner's like, okay, this is what's supposed to happen. Well, right. Until you go out and actually fight somebody who's not going to move his hand when you just slap it.
Sure.
You know, it's hard to know what really actually works, but.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's my first martial art that I trained in is Okinawa Te Karate, and then I also went to Aikido and I did Iaido. And that's one thing that you see a lot in Aikido, which is it's kind of similar to Jiu-Jitsu in the regard to, you know, when you watch it from an outsider's perspective, you see everyone's just going with the flow when the person's doing the technique. But what those people don't realize is if those people don't go with the flow, there's a potential there for injury, you know, broken wrists, bad fall, you know, whatever. So I think people get a little misrepresentation from the outside looking at it. And that's one of the things that, again, I did too, is I studied a bunch of different martial arts. My preference was always on practicality. I'm a small guy. I'm not very big and I have a big mouth. So I found myself a lot of times getting picked on, bullied, whatever, starting in high school. So I wasn't interested in the sport aspect. I'm like, what can I do to protect myself if I need to? So, you know, over the course of my training, I studied several different styles. I really kind of took to heart Bruce Lee's saying, take what is useful, discard what is not. Yep. And, you know, I worked private security. We did crowd control. We did a little bit of VIP protection. And, you know, once, like you said, once you actually use it, you start to learn what works, what doesn't.
For sure.
You know, like I said, get rid of the stuff that doesn't work. Use what works good for your body style, your temperament, you know, even conflict resolution. Some guys have a knack for it. Some guys don't. And, you know, use every tool that you have at your disposal that works for you.
Sure. That's what I liked about the McMap part of it. You know, the Marine Corps was just a big thief. All they did was go around and went, well, what can kids about 18 years old figure out how to actually use? And they went around and just stole from all these different styles and went, oh, yeah, I like that. Oh, yeah, that's probably not going
to
work. But
one of the big things that you guys probably had to work on when you learned that style is also you're doing everything with a combat gear on, right?
Combat load.
I mean, that's like a samurai wearing all his gear. I mean, it's a totally different style of how you have to do things because you have all this stuff on you. It limits your mobility. It's added weight and everything else. So I imagine they tune that specifically to, you know, what a soldier or, you know, is going to be wearing. So that's a pretty interesting aspect to it.
Yeah. That's one of the fun classes too. One of the things I laugh the most about is when you try to teach somebody how to fall. I never realized how hard it was for people to fall down. I'm like, man, you guys are just got your head right. What, you're going to break your neck.
Right. Especially
when fall down.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
It's natural to try and protect yourself. Yeah. That's what everybody does.
Yep. And it's like, man, you're going to break your wrist for sure.
Yep. And, you know, one of the things I noticed too, we used to teach self-defense. We did specifically women's self-defense courses. And one of the things that I shouldn't say always, but the bulk of the time we had a challenge with was getting people the right mindset.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with women, they can be kind of hesitant to actually use enough force to stop an attacker. I mean, we used to teach striking vital points with effective strikes. And, you know, you say, okay, we're going to teach you a technique to attack your opponent's eyes. And they're like, ooh, I don't want to do that. It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, and the thing that shocked me was every now and then in class, you'd get a woman that says, well, I wouldn't do that. I'm like, well, you know, the point of this training is you're defending your life or your well-being, your child's life or well-being, your family's life or well-being. You want to come out with the advantage in this situation to do what it takes to save yourself or save this other person. These are the types of things that we're going to teach you to do that. And they still didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to do it, basically. That kind of ooged them out, for lack of a better term. Sure. You see that a lot?
The one that I have a harder time convincing them to do is like guard and mount.
Uh-huh.
Like to try to convince somebody that, hey, when it's going bad, the best thing you can do is bring them closer to you.
Yeah.
And for them to realize, like, you mean you actually want me to basically invite them into my personal space. Yeah, it's a lot harder for them to strike you with any type of force if they're in there close.
Well, not only that, but I think if you look at teaching a woman against a man, it's very intimate. And I think sometimes there's a little bit of discomfort there.
Sure.
And when back in 1993, when the UFC first came into being, I started getting into more of the jiu-jitsu and judo stuff. And that's one thing that even myself working with female partners, etc., it takes a little bit of getting used to on both parties going to the guard or the mount because it's intimate.
But oh, yeah,
as long as you keep that focus on, you know, hey, we're training, this is why we're training, I think that helps a lot. But
what I try to convey to them and convince them is like, look, when you especially because probably a good 90% of the time this is going to go down, if it's a female, it's going to be a male attacker more than likely. You already know that statistically your strength advantage is just it goes one-sided. Right. So now it's like, okay, what can you do from this position that allows you to have leverage, which doesn't take a ton of strength to break things as long as you have leverage. But I try to tell them, like, the best part about being in the guard is the fact that the strongest part of your body is your legs, period. Yep. I don't care who you are, your strongest part's your legs. So use that to your advantage, if nothing else than to just squeeze them at the diaphragm to make it harder and harder to breathe. And everybody who's spent any time fighting knows 30 minutes or 30 seconds on a punching bag feels like, you know, 3 hours. You're like, geez, I'm worn right out.
Yep. One thing that I remember when we were doing a women's self-defense class is we had a woman in our class one time that actually been through several attacks and assaults. And she was one of the few women that I took some bruises from. She says, I've been there. I've done that. And she was going everything Deadpool style, you know, maximum effort. Yeah. And, you know, I think I came out of that with more bruises than she did. But, you know, she picked up the lessons well. She understood what it was about and she was all about it. So it was great to have that type of mindset as opposed to the other ones. They're like, I don't know if I could do that. It's like, you know, we're trying to give you the tools so you can, but a lot of it is that mindset.
Oh, it's definitely, you know, being able to put in some type of combat mindset, be able to fight for your life.
She knows what's on the line.
Well, yeah. And one of the probably the best ones we taught was we had some of the Grand Valley volleyball team. One of the girls almost got abducted in the Granville or at the Meyer.
Oh, wow.
And so her mom actually lives close to me. So she got her and some of the girls from the team and then all the siblings. And then, well, they, you know, friends found out about it. So we had a bunch of these girls and it was just kind of the same deal. You know, you're sitting here with a bunch of 17 to 24 year old girls. The last thing they want to do is, hey, I met you 5 minutes ago. Now I'm going to get on top of you type of deal. So they don't like that. Well, yep. Once it was funny to, as we sat there kind of on a break and we were just kind of talking and taking in life, you know, lessons and stuff like that. And the one girl that said, you know, they tried to grab me and force me into a van. The whole tempo of the class just changed. All of a sudden these girls became violent, which is exactly what I wanted. I'm like, right. You know, you can whoop on me all you want. I don't really care. But just the fact that you realize, hey man, this, we're not screwing around here. Like I'm trying to teach you something that potentially, you know, could save your life. And then that spawned into some of the other stuff, like, you know, hey, how do you cut zip ties and duct tape? You know, when you're bound, hey, the two best, most available restraints in the world are duct tape and zip ties. So to realize that duct tape, you know, when you turn it and wrench it, it just becomes stronger when you make it more rope-like. Well, if you turn around and leave it in its form and you literally just squat your feet, it'll just tear it in half. And you're like, oh man, it's trying to get him in that, hey, I want you to have a violent mindset, but I also want you to have a calculated, thought out mindset. Hey, if I'm going to do something, if I'm going to expend energy, it needs to be calculated and I need to be doing it for a reason so that I'm not just wasting my time, tiring myself out.
Efficiency, you know? Of movement.
Exactly.
Yep. Want to lengthen your time in the field and shorten your scouting time? Not only does the HuntWise app show you property boundaries, landowners' names, and in some cases, even their phone number, but using the app will show you the wind direction on the map of the place you want to hunt. And the HuntCast feature shows peak movement times for various species, including predators. Get the HuntWise app at www.huntwise.com, the Google Play Store, or the Apple App Store. For only $59.99 a year for Pro or $119.99 a year for Elite. Use promo code OVERDRIVE20 for 20% off an annual membership. So now let's skip forward to the firearm stuff. How far out, when you do your long range shooting, how far out are you able to shoot at your location?
So right now we're shooting 1,000.
Oh, nice. So I didn't know that. I know there's very limited areas where you can actually shoot that range. I mean, it used to be only Camp Grayling and then, you know, in terms of an actual facility, and then MTC opened up. And then are you part of that group over on the east side that was trying to open the one?
Nope. So the one I've been using is Young's Longshot in Indiana.
Oh, okay.
Because where I'm at, you know, just right there by Lansing, you know, for me to get to Young's, it's about 1 hour and 30 minutes. It was actually closer than Lake City.
Oh, nice.
So I was like, well, shoot, man, I might as well just start using that. And their facility is super nice. They've got all the ranges maintained, everything. Basically, you could show up to that place with a rifle and bullets and you're good. All the targets are the paints there. They got a gator to take you down and back and replace stuff. And it's just a very well run. They've got a 9-bay that's an indoor that's heated, so you can even shoot in the winter. And then they've got an elevated platform that lets you see everything. And we cover, the goal is you show up Friday night and we kind of do the meet and greet thing. We meet up at the range. I get a chronograph of everybody's rifle. I do my sight measurements and everything. And then I can put that all in the ballistic computer so that I know I can basically build a rough range card for just about every gun that's there. Mm-hmm. Everybody goes back, has dinner. We kind of get all that done. I get to do some range checks or whatever. Saturday morning, we get into the bulk of the book work. So we'll spend usually from around 8 or so until about 1. We'll head out to the range from that point. We'll shoot from about one to anywhere from around 8 or 9 at night, verifying our range cards, getting through all that stuff, practicing our wind reading and our range estimation and shooting positions. And, you know, the fundamentals, I think what escapes people is the fact that, you know, good shots all start at the basic. Hey, what's my parallax? You know, am I set? Am I level? You know, when you tell people, hey man, 3 degrees of cant, you know, is a 10th minute per 100 yards. They're like, what's that mean? You're like, well, right. You know, at 3 degrees of cant, if your bubble's off 3 degrees at, you know, 1,000 yards, it's 10 inches, man. It's a miss.
It's a miss.
You know,
yeah.
You know, and you're going, oh, wow. Now that makes more sense. And, you know, when you start laying it out in deer hunting terms, especially, you go, hey man, that's the difference between a shoulder and a gut right there. You know, 10 inches is definitely doable. And, you know, then we start making our targets smaller and you start getting guys that dog hunt. It's like, dude, 10 inches and you ain't going to touch nothing.
Yep.
And it's literally all from what's crazy is, especially with all this tripod shooting, because I incorporated that these last 2 years, 2.5 years that I've been teaching it. I've brought tripod shooting in. It was something I did if we had time and guys were really competent and we went into it. Well, I brought tripod shooting in and I'd like to take them out to about 600 if I can, because, you know, most guys that hunt aren't going to shoot much past 4. At something, you know, yeah.
And that's if you're lucky in Michigan.
Yeah, right. There's just not a spot around here to really reach out there and do it. But, you know, some of these guys that you see on, you know, that I've watched you guys, you know, that I follow all this stuff, and you see these guys going, yep, I pegged one at 300 yards. You know, some of that, you know, you start to realize limitations, one of the caliber while you're down there, or forgiveness of the caliber. Like, I love guys like, oh yeah, man, I just hit the woodchuck target. I'm like, yeah, you're shooting a 6.5 Creedmoor. You're not impressing me. And even that, and it's, you know, first and second focal point is huge. You know, yep. Getting guys that all thought, you know, yeah, I bought this, you know, $600 scope and it's a sweet scope. And it's like, look, man, it's in second focal plane. Now, right. Does it have its advantages? Heck yeah, it does. You know, if you actually do, you know, if your scope runs out of elevation and you turn yourself to half power, you effectively double everything that's left in the scope as far as, you know, mils go. So now a mil's not worth, you know, 3.43 or whatever. It's, you know, now worth 6, you know, almost 7. So it's like, oh, okay. Well, and then you take that into consideration. Cause I had a, you know, I shot with a second focal plane for a long time before first focal plane became like reasonably priced.
Right.
And, you know, with my second focal plane, you know, even finding, you know, teaching guys how to find a true minute of angle or a true mil, you know, hey man, like my second focal plane scope, you try to mill everything at high power. Well, I come to find out I'm milling everything and I'm getting worlds different than everybody else. Well, come to find out my true mill was actually at 11.5 power, not 14. Mm-hmm. Well, the only way to know that is to draw out a mill sheet, hang it up at 100 yards and match up your dots and then Shoot your movement and go, yeah, I'm raising exactly this much.
Yeah.
So, and then Sunday rolls around. So the goal for Sunday morning is we get out there, everybody's, you know, tired and had a good time. And, we go through our cleaning regimen. I show everybody how I take care of rifle. And then, we kind of go over, like, you know, for me, I don't know any of my buddies that were in the program that were enhanced marksmen, and the few guys that I know that were scout snipers, nobody's ever hunted man with a clean bore rifle, just not smart move.
Right.
Okay? I would never spend $4,000 on an elk hunt and head out there with a clean bore rifle. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
But that said, after we go through the regiment, we talk about fouling and, you know, what copper does to the barrel and what carbon does to the barrel and how and when we remove it and that kind of stuff. New this year, August will be my first run of it, but we have always done a clean cold bore shot. So we'll start out and I have you range your own dead space target. So I put out some man targets on the range. We know our known size of the target. So that teaches you how to range with mil dots and actually do the conversions and do the math and do some ranging. Cause, you know, range finders are neat, but batteries suck and they always die when you need them. So we do that. We do the wind call. I have them dial their own stuff. And then the goal is by the end of Sunday, you can read your own wind for the most part. You know, obviously we're going to have errors, be able to dope something with the scope, have a good range card that functions and be able to land a shot. And so this year I've added in where you'll be able to pay. I've got patches made. So now for $1, you can buy in and I got 500, 800, and 1,000. You can choose your one for $1 and take one clean cold bore shot at those ranges. And if you hit, you get a patch. If you don't,
nice.
I'm back next year.
Right.
So the goal was to kind of make it something more, even more exclusive. You know, we based it off, you know, we were talking about it one day at the shop and I said, you know, I'll never claim to be a sniper because I never got a hog's tooth, and I mean, would have been sweet to get one, but cards were what they were. So, but having that exclusive, you know, being able to say, hey, I went to this class and at 800 yards after I learned it, I was able to punch steel with a clean, cold rifle and, you know, hit target on the first, with what I learned. So I don't think you'll see a lot of these patches floating around real soon, but hopefully we'll see a few over the next couple of years. People will be getting it.
Right. And that just takes a lot of time. And that's one thing I think in Michigan is you just don't see a lot of that. And, you know, facilities and trainers like yourself and what you guys offer and, you know, MTC and whoever else around is bringing that to the Michigan crowd more, which I like to see personally. I think it's another, going back to martial arts, having strong fundamentals is going to make you better on everything further out. You know, like you said, you may not be a good high kicker, but if you have a strong kick, it's still going to work. If you have a basics on what that kick's going to be, it's going to work. And same thing with shooting. You may not have regular opportunities to shoot a target at over 400 yards, but if you know you can make that shot, chances are the ones closer are going to be a whole lot easier.
Sure.
So having those strong fundamentals off the bat is just going to make you better off in the field.
Well, and we've seen, you know, a strong influx now that it's been going for so long. This last 5 years, really, I've been getting a lot more customers that are like, hey man, I drew an elk tag in this spot out west. Mm-hmm. This is a $5,000 hunt. At this point, what's $575 to learn how to actually pull off a shot at 600 yards.
So that brings up, go ahead.
And, you know, my best one was, this last guy, I did a custom load for the rifle. So he had a 300 short mag. He drew a New Mexico bull tag and he shot a, it's a 398, I think it was something like that. And he shot his furthest shot when I met him, he'd never shot a rifle past 150 yards. So nice. We took him out to range and did everything, and he ended up killing his bull at about 360.
Nice.
One shot, dropped it.
Perfect. So,
you know, he sent me a picture. I mean, this guy, you couldn't have got a bigger smile on him. He's holding on to that gigantic bull elk. And I said, oh, I take tips and tenderloin.
Right? Yeah, sure. That brings up an interesting point. We went out to Wyoming 3 years ago with myself and Joe Mintz, one of our other teammates. And we visited the Best of the West facility out there. Have you ever heard of them?
You know, it rings a bell, but I don't think refresh me.
They used to have a TV show, and that's what they specialized yes. in was long range hunting.
And they came out with the turrets that were one of the first ones that were ballistic yep. compensated turrets. Yep, yep, I remember.
And they were specific, you know, back then, like when they had the TV show, and I got their DVD series here. They primarily used Berger bullets. And their favorite calibers were 243, 7 mag, and 300 Win mag. And I don't remember the brand of scope they used back then, but when we visited them, they had switched to, I think it's like a Husqvarna or something scope, which is a new deal on them. But they teach classes specifically for hunters for long range hunting. Is that anything that you've thought about doing?
Yeah,
or
so
feel your class covers that anyway. So just come to the regular class.
Well, that's kind of where, my focus was obviously, you know, even when you're teaching self-defense, you're not out there going, hey, the goal is to shoot human beings. But right. I mean, the fundamentals will go in either direction, but yes, my focus currently anyway is four-legged critters anyway.
Okay.
So what I'd love to see sooner than later is I want to find a spot to train that has some hills to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's our biggest drawback is, you know, this state and then, you know, Ohio and because there's a spot in Ohio you could shoot a mile.
Right.
That's all well and good, but if it's all flat ground, you know, I can go hunt antelope and, you know, in South Dakota, no yeah. problem. But, you know, when you start talking about anybody that spent any time in the mountains knowing about, you know, updraft and downdraft and what a finger does to you and what a cut does to you, and, you know, you might be shooting mountain to mountain and it's only, you know, effectively a 480-yard shot,
mm-hmm.
but with the amount of weather and ballistic changes that have gone on in 480 yards, you know, where in Michigan, you'd be like 480 yards. I'll do that every day,
right.
you know, but that shot, you're like, man, I hit a tree above him, you know, and you don't realize what that weather is doing to you. I'd love to get out and shoot more. I'd like to find a place to shoot in the mountains is what I'd like to do.
Oh yeah.
But that's, you know, that's the hard part is I think, you know, fundamentally there's just really no great way to teach it. The thing I do love about the place we use in Indiana and why I've stayed this whole time is the way they have the range laid out. There are three different sections of woods that are on both sides of the range, and they start and stop in different spots. It's the only place I've been able to find multiple crossing winds that would simulate something like an updraft or a, you know, shooting across a cut or something like that, where you can say, oh yeah, my wind call, you could look down range, say, oh, my wind call is 1.5 mils. Yeah. But did you take into account the freaking 3/4 of a mil you're getting in the other direction? So all of a sudden, you know, you're trying to do this math and you're like, all right, my wind call is really only 3/4 of a mil because everything's crossed over.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, I tell everybody in the class, we tell them all weekend. I tell you, anytime anybody talks to me, you know, weekend shooters study ballistic, you know, ballistic tables, marksmen study the wind. So, you know, if you can shoot in the wind, you can shoot anything. I mean, you know, even Chris Kyle said it in his book, you know, I was just a monkey behind a gun. The technology is here.
Yeah.
So, you know, being able to, you know, shoot my rifle across a Doppler chronograph, which is my opinion, the cat's butt right now. I love that tool. I can't believe I waited so long to buy one. You know, to be able to look at that and go, all right, I know exactly what my rifle is going to do. Mm-hmm. Pair that with my Kestrel wind reader that already keeps my applied ballistics tables in it, and scroll down to what I want and it's selected. I mean, if I know the range, it's going to tell me exactly what to do. Now it really becomes up to wind at that point. Can you adjust for the spin drift in the wind and actually hit something?
Okay. So here's kind of a personal question for you. This or digital, which do you use, or do you use both?
So, I don't have mine in the truck right now, but I'm a paper data book guy. I do have, if I was to recommend a ballistics program as far as the tablet goes, because I do use them, Applied Ballistics is the one I like the most. I have played around with the Lapua one, the Hornady one. There's a handful of different ones. As far as features go and comfortable with using it and the ability to draw up range cards and change things on the fly, the one I used on my 3/4 mile shot was the Applied Ballistics one, because it would factor in what I wanted. But as far as data books go, Impact data books, I think, are the best ones. As far as companies go, for a ready-made one that's somewhat caliber specific, what I like is the first like 6 or 8 pages cover all kinds of stuff. It's got all your formulas in it, your conversions from metric to to US. It's got common sizes when you're doing milling. It'll tell you how wide a stop sign is, what a fence post looks like, how tall that is, you know, common animals like woodchucks. So when you're doing milling, you say, oh, I see this out there. All I got to do is mill that and know it's that size. Hey, this is my range.
So to interrupt you for just a second, because I forgot we're doing audio, not video here. What I just showed Kyle was a rifle data book. And back in the day, that's primarily what was used, is every rifleman had the data book where you record the data, you record cold bore shots, shots at different ranges, range cards, everything in a book that's specific to a gun and load. Now you're seeing a trend to a lot of electronic or digital things that, you know, will have that same data, right, and an electronic unit, whether it's, you know, on a tablet, or I know there's some that are specific just for rifle shooting. Am I right?
Yes. And I mean, even ones like the Applied Ballistics program and my, my lab radar, even for my chrono data, that one literally has a phone app. I can I can look at it right on in the palm of my hand. But the hard part for me is the old Marine in me won't ever die. And anything that runs on battery or needs service for anything is never going to be good come combat time.
That was going to be the next thing I was going to say, is batteries always die. So it's good to have a hard copy.
And that's, you know, when I started looking at it, you know, when I tell people, they're like, oh, I got this, or I've got this rangefinder, the guys that have been running like the Eliminator, the Burris Eliminator, when it came out, you know, going, oh, well, I just have to range it. The scope does the adjustment for me. Yeah. Till the battery dies.
Right.
And you're going, man, I'm staring at a 400-inch bull elk on a $5,000 hunt and my battery's dead and I can't freaking do nothing about it.
Yep.
I've come a long way with even the complexity of reticles. Mm-hmm. Is gone just crazy. Yeah. And when I started, it was mil dots, man. If you didn't run mil dots, you were wrong.
Yep.
And then from that, it went to the TMR, because I could be more finite with my milling. And currently the one I run, and now there's tons like him, I run a Horus 56 in my optic, and then I got a Horus 36 in my spotting scope, so they match up to each other.
Nice.
Once you get past how busy everything is going on in there and you start using it, oh man,
makes everything faster.
Oh, tons, you know, to start shooting at distance and go, you know, when I first got my Horus 56, I was still dialing dope on the thing. And I'm like, what am I doing? I paid $3,200 for this piece of glass, idiot. Use it. Right. And so I'm like, oh yeah, all I gotta just hold up and over and hold up and over and hold up and over. And I'm like, oh man, this is, and what I loved about it was really the corrections, like a follow-up. You saw your impact. I didn't really need a spotter at that point. I could say, oh, I effed up, it's over here. And the grid was already lined up with where I should have put it, switch the grid and send it. And when you start telling people, hey man, you know, that bullet takes 1.7 seconds to make it 1,000 yards. The sound gets there in almost twice the time. If you're fast and you can run the bullet and see the correction, the second bullet can already be on its way before the animal even goes, what the heck was that noise?
Right.
And with suppressed now, let's change the game even more, you know, to be able to say, look, man, you can effectively have an error at range and be able to correct it and still do what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So next question I'd have for you is, how many of the guns that you shoot, let's say long range or in your courses, are dual purpose for you? Do you have any that you'll shoot a competition with, but you'll also take out hunting?
Yeah. So everything that I built for the most part was dedicated to doing the four-legged / two-legged varmint hunt.
Okay.
As far as a comp rifle went, you know, I only own one that I would even consider to be more of a competition rifle. And I still would call that, you know, a heavier version of a deer gun. But yeah, most of the stuff that I run was built for the purpose of harvesting animals.
Okay.
And I work around that because, you know, I feel like when I'm going out to learn this craft, the craft isn't for me to sit like F-class shooters, you know, hey man, more power to you. It's not my cup of tea because I'm not the guy pulling the trigger. And it's like, hey man, I get it. But if, you know, if you were into building precision rifles to do that and really knowing, you know, I'm even not a shooter, you know, I'm a bipod shooter or a tripod shooter or a bag shooter. I'm not a lead sled shooter very often. The only time you'll find any rifles I use in a lead sled is when I'm load developing for resale. So I can say, guys, hey, look, man, this bullet's going to do this, whether you can hold the gun still enough or not.
Right.
But yeah, other than that, it's, you know, my guns were purpose built for use, and some of them are a little heavier than they need to be, but, you know, heavy gun shoot. That's the moral of that story.
Just gotta be stronger, right?
That's right. You just gotta, you know, one day I'm going to hit the age where it's like, screw this, man. I'll take the whooping on the shoulder one night. Right.
So do you have a preference, bolt or semi?
If I'm going distance, I kind of like a bolt gun.
Okay.
I feel like, in my opinion, pressures stay more consistent. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, that said, I have shot lots of gas guns out to range when we first were monkeying around with the 6mm Creedmoors in the gas guns, the short one, or 6mm Grendels rather, in the gas guns, which I think is an amazing cartridge. It blew my mind when I started helping them guys go through that. I was like, man, this is sweet. You know, I was holding, you know, 8.5-inch groups at 900 with a gas gun. I was like, man, this is sweet. I think the more important question is, if I'm going to do a gas gun, is it direct gas or is it gas piston? And as Mark LaRue said it best, you know, if you want to shoot range, you know, nobody in the military shoots a gas piston gun at range. When you think of the fundamental reason, when you're like, hey man, you're hitting the rod with a hammer, is what you're doing.
Right.
Okay. And you know, when he outlines, he's like, yeah, the AK is basically a gas piston gun. You know, it's not accurate at range. You look at a direct, you look at a direct gas gun like the AR-15 or the M-16 or whatever. It's inherently accurate because it builds steady pressure to the rear.
Yeah.
So yeah, if I'm going to do that, if I'm going to go gas gun, it's going to be a direct gas gun. Myself, for semi-autos, obviously it's AR platforms, what I'm most comfortable with. It's the ones I like, but it's not to say I can't shoot anything else that's in a semi-auto version. I've even had guys take the class for like deer rifles and stuff. As long as you know, I like getting with all my, with the students before we get down there and say, hey man, what are we working with? So that I can tell you honest to God, hey man, don't waste $575. You're not going to make it. Or, hey, yeah, that gun will do what we're asking, but don't expect to hit ranges much past this. And as long as you know that, and you know, I've had guys come down and say, look, I brought this 20-inch 223 with, you know, 77 grain bullets. What's my odds of going a grand? Can it happen? Yeah, it can happen. Conditions are going to have to be pretty much perfect for us to do it. But I can tell you that out to 700 or 800 yards, I can get you on steel all day long.
Yeah.
So as long as we know what we're getting into when we start and you have a realistic expectation, then, you know, we're going to have a fun time. I love the class most because when you start talking about classes as far as instructor, you know, time spent, you literally, when I meet you Friday night, we barely part ways for the next 2.5 days. We go to dinner together. You know, we're hanging around the hotel. We eat breakfast together. There's never not a time where somebody doesn't go, all right, man, riddle me this one. you know, and we're sitting there having a beer after, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night. It's like, you know, we're always there. So as far as, you know, bang for the buck goes, I don't think you get any better than that. And I usually limit the long range to 8, mm-hmm. and we typically run somewhere around 6 guys. So you get a ton of, you know, well, you have 3 instructors, so you'll end up, yeah, it's basically you got one of us for every two, for every shooter spotter. So you get an awful lot of one-on-one with us. I feel like it's probably, as far as money goes, your best value, especially if you're headed somewhere to hunt at range.
So one more personal question for you, then we'll go on a little bit more to some more of your business. What is your favorite cartridge to shoot right now for hunting? Predator hunting.
So when I predator hunt, I know the 223 gets a lot of dogging. I like shooting it. For one, I own a bunch of them, so that's helpful. If I was to pick another rifle to shoot at dogs that I didn't already own, I would probably do anything in a 6mm family. Okay. I feel like the bullet flies super flat. Most of the time, they're super consistent. Like, even the 6mm Creedmoor surprised me with, I mean, I knew it would probably be really accurate because the 6.5 is, and mm-hmm. the 243 does good, and I figure you pair the two together, you're doing all right. But, you know, I would, if I was going to build a gun right now to hunt dogs, it would either be a 6mm Grendel, or I would build a 243 to hunt with personally. Right.
So now on your business side, obviously, you know, the industry itself is experiencing a crazy amount of shortages on components. I'm sure you're seeing that as well.
Yep.
But prior to that, when things were still, we were living in the salad days of all that stuff. What was your number one selling ammunition that you guys offered?
I actually sold probably the most. 224 Valkyrie and 22 Nosler were probably the two I sold the very most of, next to 223, which for us, 223 is kind of a bread and butter. I mean, yeah. I was making that no matter what. But as far as the kind of the cartridges that were coming out, you know, that were outside the box, as far as the small family went and the 22 cal, it was those two. The Valkyrie mainly, because I mean, I can't even tell you how many people told me I bought this gun or I spent money on this gun and I can't get it. It doesn't group for crap.
I've heard that a lot with a Valkyrie.
And I just went with, well, you know what? That 69 grain TMK that Sierra tells you you're not even supposed to shoot at animals, but blows about a pop can size hole in them. Seems to run absolutely amazing out of that gun. And I've had, you know, like Tom Dixon's one of the guys that's been shooting that bullet since I started it. And he's like, dude, and he shoots his out of a 224. And he's like, it lambastes them, man. It puts them right down. Mm-hmm. The bigger cartridges, the 6.5 Grendel, I probably made the most of in the bigger cartridges.
Nice. Go through the process of a little bit without giving away any secrets, obviously, but when you develop a ammunition cartridge that you're going to carry to sell to people, what's your process for choosing the bullet and the load? Because, you know, these are going to be used again, probably a good cross section of different guns if it's going to be a mass offering. Yep. So what do you look for when you're trying to choose your components to develop a load for sale to consumers?
So the first thing I'll do is once I get enough people that have asked me, hey, do you load this? I'll say, okay, once I probably get 10 or 15 guys that ask me in the course of 3 months, if I don't already load it, I'll start looking at loading it. My first question I ask them is, what's your barrel length and twist rate? That's going to guide me to what size bullets we probably want to go with. Mm-hmm. As far as weight goes, as far as choosing a bullet, I'm not brand loyal to anyone. So I'll load Bergers or I'll load, you know, Hornady's or I'll load, you know, Sierras or Noslers or whatever. But when I start, I typically start with ones that I'm very familiar with. So I will usually start with a Sierra or a Nosler just because I use a ton of them. Hornady's probably my third right after that. When I go through that, like I said, I usually base it off the twist rate of the rifle, and that gives me a good wheelhouse on where I'm going to start running it. Then after that comes the research of, hey man, how fast does this thing like to go typically? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you spend hours on all kinds of forums and all kinds of this and that and talking to guys and, okay, what do you think? And, you know, what do you think? And, oh, I've been shooting this one and, you know, kind of run with that. Powder selection becomes my next point. You know, hey, I want to go fast. Or if it's a bullet, say, I want to go fast. All right, well, what do I got in the wheelhouse that's going to burn, you know, quick, give me a lot of pressure and stuff. Myself, when I start to choose powders, anytime I can go temperature insensitive, I do it.
Yep.
Because the suck part about Michigan is one day it's snowing and one day it's 60 degrees.
Right.
And that was one of my biggest complaints when I started into this, that guys that were shooting ammos that were made either down south or out west, it was like, hey man, when it gets 12 degrees in February around here, this gun just don't like it.
Yeah.
It shoots great in the summer, but it just don't do good here. I said, well, I want a bullet that it don't matter if it's July or if it's January, when you throw it down the pipe, it's going to do the same thing. So if there's an offering that'll give me that, I'll try to go that way. If there's not a main offering that gives me the speed, I still may pick a temperature insensitive powder over a powder that gives me speed just because of the environment that we're in. Hey, you know what? Yeah, this bullet might run 200 feet per second slower, but it's always going to run 200 feet per second slower.
Be more consistent.
Yep. And so then when I start my lot to lot stuff, typically for me, the hardest part will be when it becomes exotic is finding a rifle to test it in. Mm-hmm. So most of the stuff obviously that we offer already, either I owned it, the company, like the 6mm Grendels, those guys sent me a barrel, or I've got a buddy that owns one. So we kind of start there. Typically what I do is I look at my max OALs and I back off, you know, a thou or so, or depending on what we're at. I try to work somewhere right in the middle, because usually most any distance gun likes to be closer to lands and grooves if it can get there. So I'll sit there and go, all right, well, I'm going to work from there. And then I do mine in 2/10 increments on as far as powder goes. And I do 10 shot groups.
Okay.
And then once I get
a ladder testing,
once I get a load that I like for, as far as grouping, cause that's kind of more where I'm at. And then I go across my chronograph and then I get my standard deviations and then, you know, get my feet per seconds. And I want to see, you know, how consistent is it going to be? And then what I'll do is see what it's supposed to do. Cause I'll build a load. I've got load charts for or range charts for every one of them. So then I'll go through and say, okay, well, 200 is supposed to do this, 300 is supposed to do that. So I can actually go through and verify that and say, okay, well, does it actually do this? I still do that at 100 yards just for lack of space sometimes. But, you know, if you build, like you said, a ladder chart and I just go, okay, well, it's supposed to go up, you know, 4.5, you know, inches at 200. Well, if I put my 200 yard dope and I fire the round and it goes 4.5 inches above my zero, then yep, we're probably pretty good there. And I run it off of that. So when I do my, you know, obviously load testing days is the fun one for all the guys because we get to go shoot and it takes about 10 hours
right.
to get them all done because I try not to heat anything up or, you know, I want a pretty good consistency. The only time I'll ever really stop shy of 10 rounds per load is if I shoot 5 and then we're talking, I can cover it with a dime. I don't need to shoot the rest of them. I got a pretty good idea of what we're dealing with. So that's the fun part. Then you get to go back and I make them pull all the other ones apart. Yeah, we don't need any of this stuff anymore. This right. round's not going to shoot here. So yeah. We're just going to run with this. Well, the super popular stuff, I'll play around as when I had a lot more components, I would play around with, hey, I found a load that shoots really good and groups really sweet. How fast can I make it go and it still do that? Mm-hmm. How slow can I make it go and do that? Hey, can I change my seat depths? Because like you said, the one that always makes me nervous is all the auto load and gas guns. Man, what I actually ran into right in the beginning was even though the gun loved to shoot at, you know, a couple thousandths below maximum, if you chambered the same bullet 3 or 4 times, I don't care how hard you crimp the sound gun, eventually that bullet starts to work forward. And it was a huge problem in the 450s and the 350s because the straight wall cartridges love to walk forward.
Yeah,
doesn't matter what you do. So then it was like, all right, well, how far can I push it in to make sure it's reliable over and over again and still get a group that's worth the crap? And obviously, you know, almost everybody I've dealt with during this realizes that, hey man, sometimes no matter what I do, a gun doesn't like a bullet. It's just the way that it is.
So I had a discussion with a guy at work last week. I think it was, we're talking about 450 Bushmaster. Now that's a load that you guys offer, right?
Yep. I offer it in 200 grain, 225 and 250. The 225s and the 250s are Hornady FTX bullets. And the 200 grainers is a Barnes TSX bullet.
Okay. Now the customers that have used the FTX bullet, have you gotten field reports back from them? Cause I've heard a lot of mixed reviews on those FTXs.
So I'll give you the trade secret on the FTX bullet that I found. So one day we were drinking beer in the barn and that's when I had my best ideas. I was sitting there going, it's a 45 caliber bullet. A 45 was never meant to go 2,700 feet per second. And you'll never convince me that it was.
Yep.
So I turned around and I actually went to the bottom of the load spectrum on that one. And I slowed that sucker down to about 2560. And man, did I get blood trails.
Oh yeah.
Held I started better? Getting a bullet. I gave it a chance to open.
Okay.
And the guys that have shot them since then, you know, most of the guys are telling me, man, I watch it fall down. Or, you know, I can at least go down and go, okay, I can track it. It was the same problem. The 350 runs across some of the same problems. And it's the FTX family because I'll load for the 350. I load a 147 XTP hollow point, which it wreaks the havoc. Mm-hmm. I load a 165 FTX bullet, which does a great job. There's just not a ton of blood. I load a 170 and a 180 that are like a spear point bullet.
Okay.
So they work. good, but last season was the first time before I released the 165s, I hunted with the 165 the whole season. Every deer I shot died, but I had to play around with my load data because the first two that I shot, even though I watched them fall, they went literally 50 yards with no blood. When I got there, it looked like a bloodbath. There's blood everywhere. But, you know, that's hard when you're hunting swamp and thick stuff. If you're hunting edge of field, it's no big deal. I can watch the thing run off and die. It's no big deal. But yeah, the Hornady bullet was not a friendly bullet to start with. I don't know why the FTX just didn't open good, but when I slowed it down, it did way better. The Barnes bullet, that was never a problem. You can run that sucker pretty fast and it will definitely play the hate.
Yep. I use the FTX in my 45-70 and I shot my first bear with that round. And it was funny because at camp, I was the guy with the biggest gun. I had the 45-70. We had one guy had a 6.5 Grendel, one guy had a 308. Both those guys shot their bear and they dropped in their tracks. I shot my bear, the 45-70. It ran like 30 yards. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here?
Right.
Well, obviously no shot placement is part of it, but I did get a pass through on the bullet, but we found that jacket completely separated from the core of the bullet, which I personally don't like that type of performance. I want it to hold together a little bit better. So I also have some, I think it's like 260 grain Barnes bullets for that too, but I haven't played around with them yet. But if I use that rifle a bit more, I might switch to that and see how they do. Either that or I'll go back to the 405 grain Remington soft points.
Yep. Those ones expand.
Right. It's like throwing a brick at something.
Yep.
And I've used Barnes in my 6.5 Grendel. I've taken deer with those and coyotes on accident because that's what I had in the gun when I shot the coyote, and those always have performed well for me too. So I know we get a lot of hand loaders around, and one question that you see, I think, on a pretty regular basis is crimp or don't crimp. My personal feeling is on my bolt guns, I don't crimp.
I don't either.
Semi-autos, I always crimp. Yep. And when I crimp, I use a Lee factory crimp because I don't like a roll crimp. What's your opinion on that?
So same for me for the most part. When I know it's a bolt gun, like my bolt guns, all I do is set neck tension and then seat my bullets. For the gas guns, I crimp, you know, for those. For my manufactured stuff, I crimp everything because I don't know what they're putting it in. Unless you specify, you know, hey, I'm loading it in this gun, this is what I want to do, then yeah, you know, I can do either.
Are you using a roll crimp, a taper
crimp? I use Lee crimp dies for pretty much everything. Or Dillon's crimp die. Okay. Depends on which system I have. But
yeah. Now is the Dillon similar to the Lee?
It's just a crimping.
Yep. Nice. I guess I didn't realize Dillon offered that.
Yep.
I have yet to use a Dillon press. I've seen them. I have buddies that have them, and I have yet to have one, but I really would like to have one if I was doing more volume shooting. When I was doing a lot of like IDPA and IPSC stuff, I was using a Lee Loadmaster, which I had it tuned great. I could crank rounds out like nobody's business. I loaned it to a buddy, and after I got it back, it never worked the same. So I just got rid of it. But yeah, those Dillons are worth the money if you can get your hands on
them. Oh, for sure. I started with a Loadmaster. And the thing I hated the absolute most that got me away from the Loadmaster was their auto prime. I hated that plastic part. I had about 30 of them in the drawer every day.
Right.
And I switched to, now I have 5 Dillons. And as long as you keep spare parts kits for everything, you don't break a whole lot of stuff. But I mean, you can, if you get going, but as far as smooth goes in volume of the ones I've used, I had an RCBS for a while. I still do the bulk of my precision, like if you were to call me and say, hey, I want to build a load for my rifle and you want to drop me or ship me the gun and I build it for you. When I do those, I do them in case lots of 100 and I do those all single stage. So I do everything one off. So you want accurate rounds. It costs money because that one it takes for freaking ever, but it's something we do.
Another question on preference then, if you're using the Dillon, it has an automatic powder dispenser, right?
Sure. Yep. Okay. Some of mine do. Yeah.
So, but when you're doing load development, do you still use that or do you go to a balance beam or a digital?
Nope. I have I have 2 digitals. I use a Lyman digital scale that processes it for me and shoots it out, Powder Master or whatever it's called. And then I have a second digital that I verify the weight with, and then we go up from there. My first Lyman one, I wasn't that impressed with. The Hornady one, I hated completely. Lyman came out and redesigned their trickler spout. And I like that because when I started this way, the first time I did it, I used an RCBS hand trickler and I did every round, spun them out one at a time. I was like, yep, this is not going to work for me. Right. This is taking way too long.
No money to it.
Yeah, this is taking way too damn long.
Right. Now for your preferred varmint load and your 223, what are you running? Are you running 70 Nosler?
I run a 69 Grand Sierra TMK out of mine.
So are you shooting a 1-8 or 1-7?
Yep. Both of my options. I have a 16 inch barreled one. That's a 1-7. And then I got a 20 inch that I don't know why I keep burdening myself with taking it to the field, but I built it purpose built to be a heavy gun and it shoots great. And that one's a 1-8, but okay. Yep, it likes a little bit heavier. It'll shoot 62 grainers pretty good too. Both of them will.
Okay. Nice. What's the biggest caliber that you currently offer through First to Fight?
So you can pretty much ask me for about anything on the website. I think we stop at like 308.
Okay.
If you contact me direct, I do 300 short mag, 300 win mag, 7 mag, 270. I load pretty much everything that's common. And at this point, if there's enough guys that ask me, I mean, we're so far in the game now, what's $35 on a set of dies?
Right.
So
nice. Now, how many different offerings do you have currently?
Most of the major pistols, so everything from 380 auto, 40, 45, 9, 357, 44 mag, 38 special. That's pretty much the common for that. And then as far as rifles go, we go 223, 224, 22 Nosler. Like I said, all the big ones, 7 mag, 300, 300 short mag, 270, 30-06, 308. 6.5 Grendel, 6.5 Creedmoor, 6mm Creedmoor, 6mm Grendel,
22-250,
243, 450 Bushmaster, 350 Legend. I think that covers the bulk of them.
So you have pretty good selection there.
Yeah.
Now, would you say right now, pretty much everything in general is hard to get, or have you found some that you've been able to get your hands on easier than others?
So the common stuff, the 22 caliber stuff starting to come back, the 9mm stuff comes back. Most of the bulk stuff is coming back and that kind of stuff. 30 caliber has really not been a major problem as far as bullet goes or brass. So anything in 308 family or 300 win or 300 short mag, I can load it. Mm-hmm. My problem there has been primers and powder.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I think, across for everybody. The best thing COVID did for me is I have load data for about 20 different powders on about every cartridge that I've made, because it's like, oh, I can get 6 pounds of this one. Well, let's make a load for it.
Yep.
So
yeah, that's one thing I've seen too, is powder and primers are just nuts. I mean, I work with several major distributors, and you know, every now and then you'll see someone post on Facebook, hey, Powder Valley has primers. Well, I'm at work, I can't get on there. And of course, by the time I can get on there, it's gone anyway.
Yeah.
And then two is just finding people that aren't gouging you on prices on it. I mean, wholesalers, from what I've seen, the prices haven't changed a whole lot at the wholesale level. I know some manufacturers have had like a 3-4% price increase, but what you're seeing is actual retailers or distributors. Midway is bad for it. And there's a bunch of other ones out there too, that, you know, primer $60 a brick. It's like, wait a minute, why is it $60 a brick? I don't know. It just seems like gouging to me.
The hardest part is what I've discovered through the whole thing is that with your sales reps, as far as wholesale goes, the squeaky wheel seems to get the grease. So if you've got the time, or somebody that has the time that works with you or whatever, that can call on your behalf, that has your account numbers and stuff, and you just keep bitching about every day.
Adam, right.
Eventually, before you know it, you get an email. Hey, buddy, I'm going to send you this stuff. Do you want it all? Well, yes, I do.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, so yeah, it was right about the time I would run out, all of a sudden, you know, after complaining, all of a sudden I get 4,000 small rifle primers, and I get 10 or 12 pounds of powder in different weights. But my Hodgson rep told me basically, you know, 8-pounders were going to be thing of the past for a while, which kind of sucks, because, you know, buying it in 1-pound containers really bites, because, you know, they hit you.
Have you ever tried any military surplus powders?
So I haven't really gone that route. The ones I've been looking at recently that don't seem to want to take any new products is like Montana powders and some of them guys that are running. I'm finally at a point now where I'd like to buy it in like 55 gallon drums if I could. The problem is, you know, nice hazmat. Keeping that much on hand is a little bit dicey.
Fire marshal is not your friend.
Yeah, well, luckily I'm on the fire department, so we're all good.
Right.
But
some strength.
Yeah, let's pull some get her through there. But yeah, it's as far as finding, you know, bulk and retail. The good part about military surplus stuff is it's usually pretty good stuff. It's usually either Hodgson 335 or Farget, or, you know, they don't skimp on, they usually use really good powder.
As far as you know,
you know, it's good stuff.
yeah, I've never really kind of gone. I did look for a while. I was doing early on. I was bidding on like grass, which would be when we were doing a lot of bulk 223 and stuff. I would get my grass through government surplus if I could. The problem I started running with that is like, it's all sight unseen and you end up with a whole lot of shit that got ran over by a tank.
Right.
And you're like, this is pretty much useless. That's right. Awesome. And yeah, it's all stuff nobody wanted to pick up.
Right.
And you know, I tell you, the big game changers were a power trimmer. Was pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And definitely a press with a swedging station made life a heck of a lot easier when you start talking about bulk stuff. So
right. I know when this pandemic first started and some of the powders started drying up, like in the Grendel, I like to use 8208 XBR.
Oh yeah.
And that was getting hard to find. I couldn't find it hardly anywhere. So I did some looking around and there's a couple of websites I use, Pat's Reloading and GIBrass.com. And they had surplus military powders. And one of them was supposed to be the equivalent of H-335. And I looked at my load data and they said, yeah, that'll run in that. So I'm like, shoot, I'll grab 8 pounds of that just in case I can't find XBR. That way sure. I have a backup. And luckily I did find some XBR, so I haven't had to crack into that, but I do have it as a backup. For my 50 BMG, that surplus powder was the cheapest way to go on that using H-5110. And then back in the day, WC-846 was real popular. And you could buy 8 pounds of WC-846 for like $50. And it was the same load data as BLC-2. And I still use that in my 223 for my hunting loads. And that stuff runs good. Occasionally, you'll still see it pop up, but the prices went up on it to where now it's not that much cheaper than commercial powder. So, I mean, when I can find it, I grab it if I think it's going to work just because you know, that way I have it.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's when you start telling people, you know, when they're going, oh, have you seen any of this? And you're like, dude, I buy powder like hundreds of pounds at a time. And that's so
that's the best way to do it, though. Otherwise, you're getting jacked on shipping and hazmat.
For sure. For sure. Well, and then even like some of these powders, like I said, being able to expand and start looking at some stuff that I've never really, you know, looked twice at, like the NS powders, the was it Vittori or something like that. They're kind of expensive. That one's a little bit more expensive. Seems to burn good. Seems to shoot pretty good, but I can't justify the cost in it when I'm getting, you know, almost the same performance. The one that was a real good sleeper for a while that kept me really making rounds was IMR's 4166, which burns just about like Varget burns. And so it was like, oh, well, nobody's using this. I was buying that, you know, 40 some pounds at a time. Yeah, nobody knows about it yet. And all of a sudden I was like, yep, everybody figured it out.
Yep, now it's gone again.
Everything. So, yep. That one's been my, you know, between that, Benchmark was another good one that would run in just about anything. Mm-hmm. You know, because obviously once I start, you know, for me doing as many loads as I'm making, if I can find a powder that I can run in a bunch of stuff, well, shoot, man, then it justifies me buying 60 pounds of it or whatever,
right?
You know, and then that was like with Varget, Benchmark, or 4166, you know, I could run it 308, 243, 22, 250. I could even run it 223 if I really want to slam it home in there. But I could run almost all my big cartridges on that and go, man, this is sweet. I don't have to change over. All I got to do is change my powder measure. Right. But yeah, as far as like my powder runs go for when I'm making the rounds, I use Dylan's powder bar, and then all of mine have powder checks on them with powder check stations and stuff. And then obviously, you know, I usually run 100 through, and then I'll check about every, you know, 20th or 40th one and be like, hey, let's dump one out, see if we're still running what we're running.
Now, what about your packaging? Has that been hard to maintain getting that stuff for your packaging?
You know, it was for a little bit. It's been kind of up and down. Anybody that knows that's been ordering for a while realizes that we've gone from like the smoke colored case, which I really liked, to like lime green and red and just about anything MTM had on the shelf. Yeah. So I could get it and make them. But, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, I think a lot of guys, I took that from the duck hunting world because I love to duck hunt and I hate boxes of shotgun shells in the water. They don't get along good. So I was running MTM cases for shooting birds for a long time just because of the water factor. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to do the same thing for the predator loads and the deer loads, because man, nothing sucks worse than a cardboard box of shells falling apart. It right. just sucks.
So you don't offer any shotgun ammo right now, right?
Not right now. You know, I actually started looking at presses, but with the way things are right now, finding 209 primers and bulk shot has been really tough too. I mean, bulk shot went up from like $20 for 45 pounds to like $45 for 25 pounds. Like, that's a little bit steep for me.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, you know, target load, it just, there's no money in target load. Even when they, you know, got it around at $12 a box, there's still no money in it.
Right.
Where I'd be making money would be a predator load or a buckshot or a, you know, something that mimicked TSS or something for turkeys, you know, would be something that I'd actually feel like I could make some money on. But
so has your client base grown on a geographical level? I mean, I know obviously you probably have a fair amount of business in Michigan, but sure. Has really expanded beyond that?
Yeah. The website helped that a ton. I've shipped as far west as Colorado, and I think I did one to like Idaho, somewhere right there close to the border, Texas, Florida, all the way up through the East Coast.
Nice.
I've got some guys, and then, you know, Dakotas are big. Wisconsin's pretty big. It's been really cool to actually.
Have you had anyone try and buy from another country?
Nope. I don't deal with that. The only guys I've had that I've had to tell no to is like Alaska.
Oh, Alaska's
been tough. Yep. And then California, same, because I don't load any solid. Yep. So I have to tell them, hey man, I'd love to, but I can't.
So why not Alaska? I guess
shipping, like, you know, to go across to ship it over New Continental 48 without paying any extra. And
sure.
I'd like to help them, but hey.
Same thing with Hawaii, probably.
Hawaii's the same way. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I've that whole deal with California, the lead-free ammo. And I tell you what, that scares me when you see them trying to push that on more of a national level. I really hope that never happens.
No, I always makes me laugh. I said, okay, so I can't shoot a lead-based bullet at an animal, and I can't shoot a lead-based shot at a bird. But if I want to throw them at fish all day long, I can put the lead actually in the water. And
don't give them any ideas. I might try and change that too.
Okay, you idiots.
Right. Yep, absolutely. So what's next for the company?
So the big thing we kind of moved into that's been really tough, obviously with the component shortages and all that, is trying to stay in front of everybody. Cause even the classes have sunk because, hey, nobody's got any bullets.
Right.
Where I shifted my gears to lately is kind of more of a long-term customer base. What I found when COVID started was I gained a ton of customers. The problem was most of those customers were a one and done Florida, Alabama guys I was never going to see again anyway.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to turn around and offer something that was, hey, you guys that have stuck with me since the start of this thing and have been making me the money. That's why, when I first did I ended up probably 3 months in, I was able to buy like 2,500 Nosler 55 grain orange tip, ballistic tip bullets. I saved every amount of that, all the primers and powders. I did that all for the Predator guys because I knew we were going to come into hunting season. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, man, I'm not going to just sell this stuff to guys that just want to buy 500 of them because they don't take care of me.
Yep.
And 500 bullets isn't going to take care of me. I want the guys that have always bought, 4 to 6 boxes, something like that, that have always been hunting my bullet, that have really taken care of us. So we switched gears kind of to let everybody know, hey man, if you're taking a class, if you are a long-term customer, if you're a kind of guy that's like that, I'm saving stuff for you.
Yep.
I want you to know that, like, hey, if you get a hold of me, like, hey, I haven't seen it on the website. Yep. It's because I'm not posting on the website. Cause as fast as I put it up there, I mean, in the last 7 or 8 months, if we would load, like Will and I were in the shop one time for almost 10 days straight, we loaded 2,700 rounds of various and it was gone in 14 minutes.
Oh, wow.
It's like, holy shit, dude, man. Right. That was a week's plus worth of work. My shoulder's killing me. And it's just gone that fast. Wow. So I switched over to I had guys that wanted to do long range in June. They're like, I'd love to come. I can't get the bullets. What caliber is your rifle? I've been saving stuff for you guys. I'm making sure you have it, obviously my staff guys, I try to keep them in bullets. And then, a lot of the guys that, I try not to forget anybody, those guys that I've had for customers for a long time, where I've seen your name more than once, like, I got you, I'm going to try to take care of it. So, as far as what's next for us, it's just trying to stay. What I have noticed is like the engagement and stuff like that, even with social media, has dropped just because, you hit that stride of having to tell everybody no. Nope, yeah. Don't have it. Nope, don't have it. Nope, don't have it. When you have it, I don't know when I'll have it. So it's been trying to keep up with some new stuff. Like, we got the new hats going now, we got some new apparel, just trying to come up with stuff that, hey, like the Duracoat got big because it was like, hey man, what can I get you that doesn't require bullets?
Let me make you a one-off rifle. You know, let me make you a rifle no one else has. You go to the range or you go hunting and you pull this thing out of the case and nobody has this gun but you. And you could get out of that for reasonable, you know, it was, it was, so we, you know, Joe and I did a ton of painting in the spring here early. We did a bunch of America ones. I just got done with the one I'll have up again now that it's finished is the 1776 theme one, man. That thing is sweet. It turned out awesome.
You have pictures of all those on your Facebook page or
Some of them? Yep. I put them up on the Facebook page pretty regular. We do some of it onto the website too. So when you're kind of looking at services and you go down through there, you can see our gunsmithing and, you know, the stuff that we're offering there. Repair has been big. A lot of guys have finally, you know, kind of reached out and been like, hey, I know you do all this stuff. Do you fix them? Yeah, of course I fix them. So right now I got a Browning BAR and about 100 pieces on my bench that won't shoot. So, yeah, those have been the things. Just trying to stay versatile has been the hardest thing, is just trying to keep out there.
And for people that are listening, what is your website address?
So it's ftfts.com is the website.
Okay. Yep. So the abbreviation?
Yep, for the abbreviation for the business.
And then your Facebook page is straight out First to Fight?
Yep, First to Fight Tactical Solutions. Yep, come follow along on that. I got an Instagram, but I'm not the greatest dude at paying attention to that one. I'm trying. They tell me I need all these things. These kids these days are telling me I need all the things.
Well, yeah, and you need a TikTok account too, right?
Man, I don't know about that. But
I can't stand
it. I tried it. You know, I told the one kid when he was like, my IT guy's like, well, we need to get you on this platform, this platform. I was like, dude, I would never work if I had to keep up with all this social media junk. That's your job. Here, take some pictures and go do your thing.
Right. So, yeah, but, it's pretty crazy. I mean, the same thing here. I've had more cold calls to my business here in the past year since COVID hit than I've had in the 15 years I've been in business. Easy. Yep. Probably 3 to 4 times more. And that's the thing, same as what you were saying. You know, you got to tell people, I don't have it. Well, when you go get it, I have no idea. I mean, I've had guns on order for customers now for 6-7 months, and I keep calling my reps and I'm like, what's going on with this? And they're like, I don't know. And you know, my problem, a lot of it is I'm a small shop. I don't do big volume. So of course I'm going to be the last one to get anything. And sometimes it's hard to tell people that, but that's what the facts are. You know, I'm a small fish in a big pond. I got it ordered. That's the best I can do for you. You know, and that, and keep bugging my reps, who are probably getting tired of me calling and saying, hey, where's that new Savage Edge at? But, you know, that's the reality of what we have going on right now. Hopefully it'll straighten itself out here in the near future. You know what? I talked about this before. People are asking about, well, when primer's coming back. You know, when we had this last shortage, and I think it was right after the last Democratic candidate got elected, there's a similar shortage and run on things that was really bad. I mean, you couldn't even get 22 ammo. You couldn't get squat, but like in terms of primers, we could get Wolf primers like all day long, and Chadite and a couple others. Well, Powder Valley put out an article about that saying, well, because of the import restrictions and export restrictions due to COVID and all that, we can't even get the imported stuff like the Wolf primers. So it's hit even worse this year.
Well, I think what people don't even realize is, you know, stuff that I've learned through this, you know, the bulk of our primers are imported.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of that stuff comes from Italy.
Powders are too.
Yeah, so in the powder, and then that's the next thing, is most of the powders are, you know, a lot of the Varget and the Hodgson brand, a lot of that stuff comes from Australia.
Yep.
And not only do we have COVID, but Australia had tons of wildfire.
Right.
So, I mean, they're already behind. They were behind the eight ball before the thing even got going.
Well, didn't one of their big plants burn up too last year?
Probably. He told me the last time I talked to him, when I said, hey man, when are we going to get some Varget? I think he literally laughed at me on the phone and said, well, with everything that's going on, you probably can expect anywhere from around 2 years. Cause I love Varget. I've shot it for years and a ton of stuff, but it's been, you know, thank God 4166 has been somewhat more available, but, and it mimics it, but yeah, it was tough to hear that, like, oh, a couple of years, cool. And then, yeah, the primer shortages. But I mean, even the Wolf ones, you know, a lot of guys looked at Wolf even back when it was available, like, oh, you know, Russian primers. I've rarely seen a standard deviation from a primer set that burned better than a Wolf primer. They actually shoot really good.
I know. I loaded a bunch of mine just because, like I said, during that last shortage, that was all that was available. So I bought a bunch of it. And I normally use CCI primers, but I just started substituting for the Wolf, and I haven't seen a performance difference. I mean, those coyotes didn't complain.
Yeah, the Wolf primers, they actually burn really good. We actually ran them by choice for a long time out of the 308s that we were shooting distance rifles in. They burned good, especially when federal gold medal matches were tough to get. Mm-hmm. And then I've since switched, like you said, most of the stuff I run now is CCI stuff. I run BR2s and BR4s most of the time, especially when I don't know what it's going in. You know, I got to have something that's a Magnum primer cup so that we don't have slam fires and right. semi-auto guns and stuff. So,
yep.
Yep.
Very cool. What's Joe doing over there? Is he lost?
I think I'm here.
Yeah. you guys never showed up.
What did he say? About enough for a night?
Yeah, I don't want to hold Kyle up all night. I'm sure he's got a little bit of a drive to go.
Yeah, about an hour and 15 back. That's okay. Give me time to meditate.
Yeah, we'll right. No, we'll call it a night, and that'll be episode 5. So thanks for joining along. Thanks for listening, and subscribe wherever you're listening to, and we'll hope to see you next time.
All right. Thanks, Kyle, and thanks, Joe.